the General Labor Union stressed in the gathering that all institutions of Lebanon are threatened, as are the citizens of the country.
We need to face this collapse of institutions through social solidarity and cooperation to preserve what is left of Lebanon and the workers of the country. This cannot happen without a salvation government which confirms political stability, paving the way for economic solutions.
The crisis has deeply stressed the budget for subsidies on essential goods. Power cuts have increased in many areas, which are seeing only 2 hours of electricity per day. People are lining up at gas stations for up to 2 hours to get limited liters of petrol in their cars, while supermarkets and pharmacies are running short of supplies.
The General Labor Union in Lebanon has declared that all members, including economic bodies, Organization of Merchants, and even the Association of Banks in Lebanon, back the strike and allow their employees and workers to take part in gatherings and protests. And while this strike is to protest the main dire economic situation in the country, it is also to put pressure on the political factions to form a much-needed cabinet.
Parliament Speaker Nabih Hibiri has declared an initiative to help mediate stalled talks to form a government. The disagreement is mostly prominent between Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri and President Michel Aoun, who don't see eye to eye on the general framework of a cabinet lineup. Members of the parliament close to the speaker believe this initiative is the last resort.
This initiative is the last opportunity for the Lebanese to see some agreement on a cabinet. All political factions inside Lebanon backed this proposal, and it was also endorsed by regional and international sides, since it provides a plan for a comprehensive solution. Speaker Barry has put forth a practical framework and tactical steps to try to loosen the knot on debated issues, but this requires mutual trust and reaching a common denominator where the collapse will continue and we will all regret it then.
The World Bank has labeled Lebanon's economic crisis as one of the world's worst since the 1850s. Lack of accountability has also been one of the major reasons behind an extended, multifaceted crisis in Lebanon. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Jerusalem is closer than ever is the slogan of a symposium held in Yemeni capital Sana'a to discuss the Israel's long-lasting atrocities against the Palestinian nation. The organizers say the recent 11-day war has proved that the third generation of Palestinians is more capable of standing against Israel. They say the resistance has got stronger despite the normalization efforts of some Arab states.
The axis of resistance was able to prove its existence despite all the conspiracies of the closest people. There are Arab countries that are considered close to the Palestinian resistance, but unfortunately, they continue to stab the resistance through normalization with the Zionist entity. And these countries are the ones who seek to weaken and bring down the resistance. Today, the third generation of the Palestinians is capable more than ever of defending Palestine against Israel's aggression.
The gathering also hailed the support of allies for Palestinian cause, including Iran, who they say has always backed the Palestinian nation overtly. The participants said Iran has played a key role in changing the balance of the war between Palestine and the Israeli regime.
Since the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran 40 years ago, it has made Palestine its main issue, as Imam Khomeini declared that Iran's independence will not be complete without the liberation of Palestine. The Palestinian cause is at the heart of Iran's political strategy, and despite the conspiracies that Iran has gone through, it still supports the Palestinian resistance and has been a key factor in changing the equation of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
The Palestinian cause is also an issue of consideration for several other Islamic states, including Yemen. Last month, Yemenis launched a fundraising campaign to support the Palestinian resistance groups, even though they are going through a tragic humanitarian situation due to the ongoing Saudi war on their country.
People here believe that armed struggle is the only way to stand against aggressors. They say the recent victory proved that the Palestinian nation is on the right path to regain its rights. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana'a.
Push back, constrain and engage. These are the core elements contained in a European Commission policy proposal which has just been presented relating to Russia. The 27-country bloc's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, says the EU must be realistic.
And prepare for a further downturn of our relations with Russia, which are right now at the lowest level. And this further downturn is the most likely outlook for the time being.
The new policy proposal suggests the EU must push back against Russia's human rights violations and international law breaches. This mostly relates to Ukraine and Georgia. The EU must constrain attempts by Moscow to undermine EU interests. Here the document talks about cyber attacks. But the bloc should engage with Russia on COVID-19, climate change, travel visas, and efforts to save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal. Big claims require big evidence, and the EU has never come forward with a shred of evidence, the Kremlin insists. There are many experts who believe the EU is going down the wrong path.
The West has an interest, an institutional self-interest, in aggravating the crisis with Russia, a crisis which need never have started in the first place, but which was aggravated by the way the West supported the most radical elements in Ukraine.
Borrell was asked about the EU's dependency on Russia's energy. He responded, there is no mention of this subject at all in the policy document. The Commission proposal contains a provision for additional sanctions on Russia, but EU leaders are divided over the effectiveness of such measures. They will make their final decisions on the matter during a summit here at the European Council next week. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After two perilous days and a difficult night, 69-year-old activist Nicholas Georges has returned to ground level after mounting a huge crane overlooking the US Embassy in London. Armed with little more than a Palestinian flag, Georges risked his life in the daredevil stunt to raise awareness of Israeli crimes against the Palestinians.
Every day, day in, day out, demolishing more and more Palestinian homes. The Palestinians have no rights. Even their electricity and their water is taken from them. Israel is the fourth largest military power, nuclear military power in the world. The Palestinians have nothing.
Apart from the obvious risk of falling to his death, the two-day ordeal has been very challenging in other ways too, as explained by fellow activists supporting him from the ground.
Apart from the climb itself, which was huge, he has suffered from the cold at night because he couldn't fit a sleeping bag onto his backpack. So he spent last night very cold, and he sent a few messages saying, I'm really, really cold. Luckily, because he's so high up, the crane actually caught the first morning sun. So he was the first person to actually warm up. But now he's suffering from the heat because obviously there's no shade.
As supporters cheered Mr. George's successful landing, he was unable to speak directly to us, as any media talks after this action could affect his possible court battle to come.
So there you have it. Nick is back down safe and sound. But the battle will not end here. After a visit to hospital, Nick will likely be brought in for questioning by the police and potentially even charged for some of the conduct over the past couple of days. Then could come a lengthy court battle, which Nick will have to fight against as well. But the lessons that can be taken from this is that the activists behind these brave actions know the consequences, but they still do it anyway, meaning that until there is a solution for the oppressed Palestinian people, this type of action will continue to occur, not just in the UK, but worldwide, possibly as well. Robert Carter, London.
Supporters of Palestinians who struggle for their rights and justice gathered in front of the headquarters and branches of RAI, the Italian national broadcaster, to protest against what they call biased coverage of the ongoing conflict between Israel and Palestine. The demonstration took place in several cities, including Rome, Milan, and Naples. Protesters shouting "Shame" and "Israel, go away" accused the national broadcaster of misrepresenting the complexity of the latest Israeli war on the Gaza Strip, as well as ridiculing the truth.
questa manifestazione oggi davanti alle sedi RAI.
The reports on the Israeli-Palestine conflict that RAI TV has been airing were not up to the standards one would expect from a public broadcaster. Italian people have been clever enough to understand the truth. It's no coincidence that pro-Palestine demonstrations were held in 25 cities across the country. The reports never mentioned the Israeli occupation, never once.
People attending Rome's demonstration said the Italian media outlets faced no ethical dilemmas when it came to not reporting on the Israelis who were trying to steal Palestinians' houses in Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem or Quds.
Italian mainstream media generally covers Palestinians when they are either protesting or physically confronting Israeli aggression, with the outcry broadly described as escalation of violence. Quite the contrary when it comes to describing Israel's increasing night raids on Palestinian homes and attacks by Israeli settlers on Palestinian farmers, Italian media hardly refers to an escalation of violence.
Last Saturday, thousands of people flooded the central square in the Italian capital to show their support to the Palestinians, but no mainstream media outlets bothered to cover the demonstration.
The media didn't elaborate on what was happening in Italy. They showed, you know, London, New York, other places in the world, and they didn't really focus on all of Italy was protesting against this occupation.
2002 Ramallah.
Unfortunately, nothing will change if the UN and all major countries continue not to take a firm stance on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
A national demonstration dubbed Stop the Israeli Occupation will be held in Rome on Saturday, May 29. Thousands of Italians are expected to join the rally from all over the country. Max Civili, Rome.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
An Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. The way airplanes take off and fly in the sky. It's really fantastic. I'm at Mehrabad Airport in Tehran. I'm going to take a trip to Zahedan in Sistan and Balochistan province. Though, my main destination is a village called Ladiz in this city.
Thank you.
flight has been delayed. Okay, I'd better go to a coffee shop to have a cup of tasty Iranian tea. Ladi's rural district is in Mirjave County. Mirjave is 75 kilometers southeast of the city of Zahedan. The weather in this village is pleasant in fall, winter, and early spring, and it's hot in summer. Ladi's has a river which passes through the north of the village. The economy of Ladi's village is based on agriculture, husbandry, and handicrafts. Most agricultural products of this village include wheat, barley, pear, and peach. Animal husbandry is also booming in this village, which include various types of dairy and red meat products. Women and girls of Ladi's village play an important role in the economy of the family by weaving carpets and doing the art of needlework. The most important tourist attractions of Ladi's village include Ladi's waterfall, Ladi's cave, seasonal rivers, and the historical remains of the culture of Ladi's. I am now in Ladi's village. A wheat field is across from me, which ends in palm trees. When the wheat field and palm trees come together in a place. Magnificent, very beautiful. I had never seen such a wonderful scenery in whole of my life. Standing by the entrance of Ladi's cave. Well, let's go inside the cave to see what's happening there. Oh my God, it's extraordinary. Big drops of water flows from the ceiling and walls of the cave. The drops of water have made a permanent flow of water in the cave. The reflection of water drops in the cave gives you a wonderful feeling, as if human becomes one with nature. I like the sound of water drops. I am now at the Ladi's Handicrafts Market. Here is full of colorful, beautiful clothes. These clothes have the beautiful needlework which the women of the village have done professionally. Some of these clothes have small coins sewed on them. Dazzling. And here we have the Baluch ornaments. Oh, very beautiful. I'd buy this necklace for my grandma. She's interested in the ornaments of different ethnicities of Iran. Let me ask how much the necklace costs.
ببخشید خانم، قیمت این گردنبند چنده؟
Until next time, goodbye.
beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Debate. In this edition, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has decided to add the Yemeni resistance movement, Ansarullah, to its annual blacklist of parties violating children's rights. Now, this is happening while the ongoing war on Yemen and the continuous Saudi blockade is taking its toll on civilians, mostly women and children. In this edition, we will be scrutinizing the different aspects of this decision with a look at the bigger picture. But first, the report.
Yemen's Ansarullah movement blamed the United Nations for the Saudi atrocities committed against Yemeni children. The movement said the UN has always been providing the political cover-up for the Saudi war crimes. This came after the United Nations added the Ansarullah movement to its blacklist of groups for violating children's rights.
We were not surprised by this decision because the UN had removed the name of Saudi Arabia from its blacklist of the groups violating children's rights. The United Nations have not taken any real steps to protect the rights of Yemeni children who die every day due to continued blockade on food, medicine, and fuel. I believe that this is a resounding scandal for the Secretary General of the UN, who began his second term with this decision.
The member of the Supreme Political Council, Mohammed Al-Houthi, dismissed as baseless the UN accusation, saying it did not refer to an investigation on the ground as the movement has demanded. Meanwhile, the Minister of Information said the UN has turned a blind eye to the ongoing Saudi blockade on Yemenis, which causes the death of tens of Yemeni children on a daily basis.
This classification wasn't based on realistic data. We used to have the United Nations as a political cover for the war on Yemen and the killing of more Yemeni women and children, whether because of the continuous Saudi blockade or because of the airstrikes of Saudi fighter jets. This decision revealed to the world the true face of the United Nations, that it serves the agenda of the countries funding the UN.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war against Yemen in March 2015. The war has killed thousands of civilians, including women and children, and turned the war-torn country into the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations.
Observers say the United Nations blacklisting of Ansarullah is politically motivated and has no relation to the humanitarian situation in Yemen. They believe that the UN must take real actions against the Saudi blockade if it has real intentions to end the suffering of millions of Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
Now to continue this discussion, we're joined by Mr. Hamza Shaiban, Yemeni activist and political commentator out of the Sana, and also Ms. Judith Bello, senior member of the United National Anti-War Movement. Thank you very much to both of you. Let's begin with Mr. Shaiban. Now, how do you think this decision will impact the UN and particularly its international image?
Thank you for having me. Unfortunately, the UN continues to be a platform for countries like the US and help them to provide a political cover. Unfortunately, such a move is not based on reality, and basically it's based on falsified reports or politically motivated. We all remember the war crimes and the atrocities that the Saudi US coalition has committed in Yemen. There are thousands of clips that were documented showing dead children who are half torn sometimes. But nevertheless, this did not motivate the UN to put Saudi Arabia or US in the blacklist. We all remember the incident that happened in Saada and Dahyan, where a school bus was bombed and 52 children were killed. In Yemen now, every 75 seconds a child dies because they don't have access to food or clean water. And this is according to the director of the food program in Yemen, World Food Program.
And what you just mentioned is a direct result of the Saudi blockade on Yemen, isn't it?
Absolutely. Today in Yemen, more than 80% of the population is in need of humanitarian assistance. This is because of the blockade that is imposed by U.S. and Saudi Arabia on Sana'a's airport and Hodeidah port. Back to this move, I believe this is no different from what happened in 2016 when Secretary General Ban Ki-moon enlisted Saudi Arabia in the blacklist of groups that violated children's rights in Yemen. And Saudi Arabia, after that, threatened them that they would cut the funds that they gave them, which was approximately, I think, 100 million. A week or so after that, they had to take them off the list because, according to Ban Ki-moon, he said that they were put under pressure by Saudi Arabia that they would cut the funds. Again, this is something that definitely is not surprising from a UN, from an international institution like the UN, who should be credible. Nevertheless, they tend to be not neutral in this war, and they're not playing a very positive role in the war in Yemen. I believe that if Yemen had money and they could pay the UN, they wouldn't have enlisted Ansarullah movement in this list. We all saw what UN provided to the children in Syria, to the children in Lebanon, to the children in Palestine, most importantly. Definitely, this is a continuation of a negative role that UN is playing when it comes to protecting and providing political cover for countries like U.S. and Israel.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shaiban. You actually pointed out some very interesting issues and also that flashback to the time when Saudi Arabia paid the U.N. The U.N. actually took Saudi Arabia off the list because it was worried about the payments that it was receiving from Saudi Arabia. Let's bring in Judith Bello. Ms. Bello, if you could please tell us what you think. Is the UN chief actually serious in bringing peace to Yemen?
I don't think the UN is serious about its response to Yemen at all. They are behaving as a proxy for the Western powers right at the moment. The only base they have down there, the United Nations, which through which all the food and resources have to come into Yemen, is on a U.S. base in Djibouti. So they basically have deferred to the Western assault on Yemen, and they're riding it out rather than rejecting it. And the Saudis, the U.S. has given complete cover to the Saudis, even though they now have some stuff going on in Congress in opposition to it. The U.S. government is not terribly interested in what the people want. And they obviously have doubled down on their support of the Saudis in this matter. I think it's really a crime that it's going on the way it is. And the United Nations gives legitimacy to this nothing government of Mr. Hadi in Saudi Arabia, while at the same time they do not give legitimacy to Ansarullah, who are defending their country. And I think this right there says it all, that the United Nations in this particular matter, and they have had moments when they did a little bit better, although not frequently or not every time. In this particular matter, the United Nations is totally co-opted by their, not just Saudi money, but their major benefactor, which is the United States.
Now, Ms. Bello, Antonio Guterres is actually blacklisting Ansarullah as a party violating children's rights. Interestingly, we have witnessed Saudi Arabia and its allies purposefully targeting children. We've seen school buses being targeted by the Saudi.
Let me just say one more thing about this. You know, during the Iran-Iraq war, Saddam Hussein was mercilessly using chemical weapons on Iran and the Iranian people, and they were also using them on their own people in the Kurdish areas in the north of Iraq. And while they were doing this, Iran repeatedly, this is against the United Nations rules, so Iran repeatedly went to the United Nations and said, first they were the aggressors, and now they're attacking us with these illegal weapons. And the best that the United Nations could do, again, because this was a U.S.-instigated war, the best the United Nations could do was to condemn, quote-unquote, both parties. And they never did single out the actual perpetrator of these atrocities. And this is a problem with the UN. As the United States does not live in the real world. It lives in the world of what it wants, and it will do or say anything. When I say it, I mean the blob, the Washington blob or whatever, not necessarily the people of America. But they will do whatever they want to oppress and humiliate those who they want to overcome. And they've done this to Bashar Assad. They did it in Libya. They done with the horrific murder of Gaddafi, the president at the time. And they're doing it in Yemen by refusing legitimacy to the one group that is broadly defending the country. They did it in Gaza with Hamas. They found a way to blame them, like if Hamas, you know, retaliates against an Israeli attack, then all the deaths that come from it are Hamas's fault. This goes on and on, and I don't know the answer to it. I know that it's an evil policy, very hard to work with the American government because, as I say, they really don't care what the people think. And they, as Mr. Pompeo said a few years ago, they lie, cheat, and steal. That's their training. And they do whatever it takes. And I am very glad that Ansarilla is there defending their people. I'm not sure what this will cost them. I think it costs them what they already don't have, which is the control of incoming resources. Because what happens, of course, from the very beginning, the way the blockade works is that Saudi allies and United Arab Emirates allies get food, get the things that they need, get weapons, and Ansarilla and the people of the majority of the people of Yemen go without, because that's part of the strategy of the war. And by doing this, it's just, in my opinion, it's sort of rubbing their nose in the dirt. It's a deliberate attempt to humiliate them and to, in some ways, maybe propagandize people in the West who are foolish enough to believe whatever the UN says. But the bottom line is that stopping them is a big problem. And the Ansarilla has fought long and hard, and they've had some gains, and they're making some progress against the Saudis. So we just have to hope that in their persistence and in their connection with other countries fighting for their lives against the same group, in connection with the Palestinians, in connection with the Lebanese, which under Hezbollah, in connection with the Syrians, that if the people of the region stand together and persist, that eventually the world will retreat. That there won't be a choice to persist.
Hopefully,
Ms. Because this is so wrong.
I'm sorry to cut you off. Let's bring in Mr. Chabon, since you mentioned the U.S. Mr. Chabon, the U.S. is providing logistics and arms to Saudi Arabia to continue this war on Yemen. Why doesn't that result in any serious measures from the U.S.?
So why doesn't that
result in any serious measures from the U.N.? The U.S. is actually providing the arms, the logistics, everything for Saudi Arabia and its allies. We don't see the U.N. condemning the U.S. for that.
Yeah, as I mentioned, unfortunately, the UN is acting like a platform and providing political cover for US and other countries to do whatever they want. They basically gave them a free check to do whatever they want in Yemen, and in Palestine, and in Syria as well. I truly believe that UN cannot be as an international institution. UN is not a neutral party when it comes to defending victims and condemning the aggressors. As long as they're getting funds from Saudi Arabia, as long as U.S. is supporting them in a way or another, they will continue doing whatever they want to do, and UN will just try to beautify their image, U.S. image, and keep providing them with excuses to implement their agenda in the region, which is destabilizing the countries and making sure that they're not independent and they don't take a stance against their agenda in the region.
Ms. Bello, because of these different aspects that we have been mentioning so far during our show, Yemen's Ansarullah has slammed the decision of Antonio Guterres, calling it disgraceful. Do you believe that this view is shared by many across the world?
I actually do believe it's shared by most of the developing nations in the global south. I do not think any of them are fooled by the behavior of the United States and Saudi Arabia in this case. And that is a reason for hope in a matter like this, because much of the world sees through these actions by the United Nations and by the United States, and they are resentful of countries like Saudi Arabia. The United States blames other countries for having dictatorships while ignoring the abuses in Saudi Arabia and the murders of people that happen there at the royal discretion and so on. So I think that this is our strongest positive that we have going for us in creating a better world, is that the countries of the global south are not fooled. They all understand what's happening here, and they are gradually building their strength.
And let's not forget, Ms. Bello, let's not forget that we live in a day and age that with all of these mobile phones and different tools that people have, it's very difficult for mainstream media to shape public opinion as it used to decades ago. And it's, of course, more difficult to hide the truth. So how far do you think the UN can go?
To be honest, I don't know how far they can go. I do think that they lack legitimacy even here in the United States, because so many people feel that the United Nations has been co-opted by U.S. politics. But sadly, or maybe for the better, that many people continue to try to work with the United Nations because it's the only global forum that we have. And so they pass resolutions to do things that are often ignored, like the ones against nuclear proliferation, or the ones against, other kinds of weapons, or in support of human rights. And even though these are abused at the moment by the United States and nations, it remains that it's a global platform. And I think that's really the only legitimacy it has here, even in the United States, because it's been under attack. And that's one of the problems. You have the United States destroys its tools.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shaban. Could we hope for any change in the UN chief's angle towards this issue? Could we hope for any change in the UN chief's angle towards this issue?
Now, this depends on whether the UN is actually trying to show the truth about what's happening in, in Yemen, or whether they're trying to justify whatever the U.S. and Saudi Arabia are trying to do. As long as, the UN is being backed by Saudi petrodollars and U.S., I don't really think that anything will change. And the war in Yemen has been going on for almost 7 years.
Thank you very much. We're running out of time, so I would like to have Ms. Bello's response on this question as well. Ms. Bello, do you believe that we could expect any change?
I think there's some potential for change just in the shifting of international strength in terms of the growing strength, for instance, of China in global politics and other things that are happening that actually weaken the United States. So I think there's some possibility, but I don't see any immediate relief on the horizon because this entire war in Yemen has from the beginning been under at least the outside external control of the United States, and the United Nations has been submissive to the U.S. agenda all along. So I think long term that there's potential for relief, but not short term.
So we have to keep and continue making programs like this to raise more awareness, to get people to know what exactly is happening. Thank you very much to both of our guests, Hamza Shaban, a Yemeni activist and political commentator out of Sana'a, and Ms. Judith Bello, senior member of the United National Anti-War Movement from the U.S. Thank you very much to both of you. And thanks to all of you for following this edition of The Debate.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The current heat wave and drought leave no doubt. We are living in the dangerous effects of the climate crisis, says Jessica Corbett Ryder in an article titled Surreal and Distressing: Climate Experts' Predictions Come True with U.S. Heat Wave. Stay tuned for more. As what the National Weather Service described as dangerous and record-breaking heat affects 50 million people across the western United States even before the first day of summer, climate experts and activists are using the hot conditions to reiterate warnings and calls for policy change as scientists are seeing their dire predictions come true. The current heat wave and drought leave no doubt. We're living in the dangerous effects of the climate crisis, activist and former Democratic presidential candidate Tom Steyer tweeted recently. Action is urgently needed. Steyer shared a New York Times report on extreme heat that also caught the attention of Campaign for Nature director Brian O'Donnell, who warned that in the absence of bold action to address the climate emergency, this will all get much worse. O'Donnell's ominous warning was echoed by Daniel Swain, a Colorado-based climate scientist at the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability at the University of California, Los Angeles. We will still have a long way out from the peak of the wildfire season and the peak of dry season, Swain told the Times, adding, things are likely to get worse before they get better. The newspaper detailed some of the current conditions in the U.S. West. A heat dome is baking Arizona and Nevada. where temperatures have soared past 115 degrees this week, and doctors are warning that people can get third-degree burns from the sizzling asphalt. At Lake Mead, which supplies water for 25 million people in three southwestern states in Mexico, water levels have plunged to their lowest point since the reservoir was filled in 1930s. In California, farmers are abandoning their thirstiest crops to save others, and communities are debating whether to ration tap water. In Texas, electricity grids are under strain as residents crank their air conditioners, with utilities begging customers to turn off appliances to help avert blackouts. In Arizona, Montana, and Utah, wildfires are blazing. National Weather Service meteorologist John Salmon put it into Associated Press, while discussing temperatures in and around Las Vegas that are expected to continue this weekend, this is pretty impressive. We're seeing all-time records fall. Swain told The Guardian that the most distressing part is that this is very much in line with predictions. Climate scientists have been repeating essentially the same messages and warnings since before I was born. Catherine Hayhoe, a Texas-based climate expert and chief scientist at the Nature Conservancy, responded similarly in comments to the newspaper. The extreme heat and the wildfires aren't surprising, but it is just surreal to see what you only ever saw before in your research studies and models actually happening in real life. And you're almost dumbfounded by the speed at which your projections have become reality, she said. A recent study co-authored by Hayhoe shows Americans associate hot, dry days and extreme drought with global warming. But many people don't reach the same conclusion about extreme rainfall or flooding, despite experts' findings. Citing survey results that suggest even though about three-quarters of Americans recognize that the planet is warming, less than half think it will directly harm them. Catherine Hayhoe told The Guardian that right now is a really important time for scientists to communicate with the public that climate change is here and climate action matters. Writing for Intelligencer, David Wallace Wells, author of The Uninhabitable Earth, outlined what this summer could look like in California, which has seen some devastating and historic wildfires in recent years and beyond. Fire isn't neatly predictable, since it depends both on underlying conditions, moisture on the ground, an amount of dead flora, often called fuel, and a considerable amount of randomness, wind events, and ignitions, both human and natural. But while there is always the possibility that ignitions could be anomalously quiet and that a state could endure a year of off-the-charts conditions without having to fight and flee and breathe the smoke of a consumerate fire season, the outlook for 2021 isn't just bad. It is quite a bit worse than that. Even if you are modeling expectations of the record-setting recent past, across the American West, extreme drought conditions are more widespread than they have been in at least 20 years. The next category worse, called exceptional drought, typically rare, is already this year blanketing most of the West and Southwest. It's so widespread, it would probably be better called unprecedented drought, at least in age of modern record-keeping. This week arrives throughout the region what is expected to be a record-breaking heat wave, with temperature warnings issued for more than 50 million people. In Phoenix, it could reach 118, and in Death Valley, 127. already this spring, more than twice as many acres in California have burned as had by this point last year, when the state was on its way to more than doubling its previous fire record. Rerun last year's random ignitions on top of this year's underlying conditions, and you won't just have the worst season ever, but potentially something considerably scarier still. Get relatively lucky with fewer ignitions than is typical, and you're still probably in for sort of season that used to set state records and scar the memory of populations as recently as a decade or 2 years ago. Meanwhile, in Texas, the temperature at George Bush Intercontinental Airport passed 94 degrees for the sixth day in a row. It was the ninth consecutive day that the peak hit there was worse than normal, the Houston Chronicle reported recently. Noting that warmer weather is an expected result of human-caused climate change, the newspaper spoke with Texas State climatologist John Nielsen Gammon, who compared that area's higher temperatures arriving earlier and lasting longer to a rising tide. Our climate in Texas is changing, said Susan Scott, state director of Nature Conservancy in Texas, adding, it really affects everything from our natural resources to our economy and our quality of life. As Common Dreams reported recently, the high heat comes as negotiations between the White House and Congress over an infrastructure package drag on, and the conditions in the U.S. West are bolstering progressive lawmakers and activist position of no climate, no deal. According to Climate Power Executive Director Lori Lotz, the extreme heat, intensifying droughts, electric grids on the brink, and fires already burning hundreds of thousands of acres out west make clear that the need to include climate action in any infrastructure package should not be in question.